like to call the Hess Committee to order at 1:30. Present, three members. Senator Dyson, Senator Passman, Vice Chair, and myself, Betty Davis. We have three bills to come before us today. The agenda is going to be changed a little bit. I'm going to take Senate Bill 139 first. So I know that finance meeting, and we're going to have people in and out. So if Senator Olson will come forward and give an overview on this bill. If you have a cell phone, you need to cut them off. I'm ready when you are.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the Hess Committee. I'm Senator Donald Olson, and I'm the sponsor of Senate Bill 139. Senate Bill 139 establishes a loan repayment and incentive program that is so essential, I think, to try and encourage people to come back to Alaska and to come to Alaska to go ahead and work up here as health professionals. Currently, Alaska is facing a serious health care practitioner shortage. 2 years ago, when the Health Commission looked at some of the shortages that were here, they estimated that we needed some 400 more doctors to provide the same level of care as was available elsewhere in the country. This is certainly getting to a crisis. The state of Alaska now is in the process of developing solutions for this issue, ways to bring practitioners to our state, and to send more of our youth out to medical school so they can return and provide health care to other Alaskans. Senate Bill 139 will play an important role in the overall solution by establishing this loan repayment and incentive program so we can immediately begin to attract practitioners and employ them in Alaska. 44 of the 50 states already have a loan repayment program similar to the one that is proposed in this bill. So you can quickly understand that the competition is fierce for these graduating practitioners. 21 of these states actually offer more than this one program. But we have other reasons to attract practitioners to live here in the state of Alaska. We've got the unique landscape, the lifestyle that's up here. And having a program of our own is necessary in order to become competitive with other areas of the country so that we can offer our citizens the health care that we deserve. I just want to thank the Health and Social Services Committee for considering this bill. Now, Kendry Caesar will go ahead and present the rest of the bill. And I just want to say in closing that in rural Alaska, where we are mostly facing this acute shortage, this is very important. So with that, I thank you for this time. And here's my aide, Kendry Caesar.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me fine?
You can just speak a little louder. I'll pull it up closer. That's fine.
Good afternoon. My name is Kendry Caesar, staff to Senator Olson, and I'm here today to discuss the details of the program that's proposed through SB 139. As Senator Olson explained, Alaska is facing a serious health care shortage issue, and we would like to address this issue by establishing the Health Care Professions Loan Repayment and Incentive Program in order to make health care employment in our state more competitive and more attractive to practitioners, both who originate from Alaska, but who are from outside. Particularly in hard-to-fill localities, individuals face obstacles such as limited financial resources, cultural barriers, and geographical hindrances. And so expanding their access to health care within the state by bringing more practitioners in would make it easier for them to have the health care that they need. This program would mirror similar loan repayment and incentive programs in the lower 48 that have been substantially successful as cost-effective strategies in addressing workforce shortages, both for healthcare and otherwise. The program would be overseen by the Department of Health and Social Services. The commissioner of the department would be responsible for appointing an advisory council, and the advisory council would serve to communicate between program administrators and providers, and would make recommendations back to the commissioner regarding program administration. The commissioner will use the data and the input of the advisory council to annually prioritize 10 eligible practitioner types according to the relative need in Alaska. And then these 10 eligible practitioner types would be further prioritized into two categories, Tier 1 category and Tier 2 category. So initially, this Tier 1 category would include pharmacists, dentists, and physicians with either an MD or DO. And these are currently the types of practitioners that are in highest demand in Alaska. And it's also notable that these types of practitioners often come out of medical school with the highest amount of loans. Tier 2 practitioners will initially include dental hygienists, nurse practitioners, registered nurses, physical therapists, physician's assistants, clinical psychologists, and clinical social workers. These practitioners are also in high demand in Alaska, but to a bit of a lesser extent than the Tier 1 practitioners. Each of the 10 practitioner types will be allocated 8 to 9 slots in the program, and so the total amount of program participants accepted each year would be 90. Program participants will be placed in one of two different types of sites. A regular site could be located anywhere in the state of Alaska, and so 60 of the program slots will be allocated to regular site positions. Very hard to fill sites, on the other hand, are designated in areas that are labeled this by the commissioner, and 30 of the program slots will be allocated to very hard to fill slots. Currently, there are already federally defined healthcare shortage areas. I believe they're titled health professions shortage areas, also referred to as HPSAs. And so these federally defined HPSAs would help to guide the commissioner in identifying very hard to fill sites, but they do not limit him. The commissioner can take into account other environmental or professional factors that make a site very hard to fill. Preference will also be given to sites that serve individuals regardless of their ability to pay, including those who are uninsured and those who are covered or eligible for Medicaid and Medicare. An eligible program participant would commit to 3 years, no more and no less, in exchange for either loan repayment support, or in the case that one has no educational loans outstanding, then they could opt to participate in incentive payments, the incentive payment component of the program. A Tier 1 practitioner serving in a regular site could receive up to $35,000 per year. Or if they choose to serve in a very hard-to-fill site, they could receive up to $47,000 per year. A Tier 2 practitioner serving in a regular site could receive up to $20,000 per year, or if they choose to serve in a very hard-to-fill site, up to $27,000 per year. And these figures are the same regardless of whether they're participating in the loan repayment component or the incentive payment component. If a participant in the loan repayment component of the program completes their 3 years of service and then would like to return, they can do so as a part of the incentive payment component, but the lifetime maximum of participation is 6 years. Program funding for fiscal year 2010 would be about $7.4 million. And this is for the estimated 90 participants. The employer of a program participant might be required to pay a matching amount toward the loan repayment or in the incentive payment, but this matching amount would be determined at the commissioner's discretion, and the commissioner would take into consideration the employer's ability to pay. So there may be cases where the employer does not pay any amount towards the incentive payment or the loan repayment. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education will serve as disbursing agent for loan repayments and will make those payments directly to an eligible lender. The department will serve as disbursing agent for the incentive payments and will make those payments directly to the practitioner. We do have Diane Behrens present today of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education, so she might be able to answer questions further on that aspect of the program. The establishment of the healthcare professions loan repayment incentive program is not the be-all, end-all answer to our healthcare shortage, but it is a very important piece of the overall solution. And it's one that will allow us to provide better healthcare to Alaskans in the very near future. The $7.4 million price tag might seem quite high, but because 44 of the 50 states already offer this type of loan incentive program, We are at a severe disadvantage in being competitive for healthcare recruitment and retention. In order to make a significant impact on our healthcare shortage, significant funds will have to be expended. There is no cheap solution to this issue. Again, thank you to the Senate Health and Social Services Committee for considering this bill. I'd like to again point out that we have Diane Behrens present, but also we have Rod Beattie of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. He was one of the, he played a key role in developing the program proposing this bill, so he might also be able to answer questions that I am not, so I might defer some questions to him. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There is somebody, Diane Behrens, here. I know, is that somebody from Health and Social Services here to speak to this bill? What I'd like for you to do is to come up, if you don't mind, at this time, unless the sponsor has more to add.
No, I'm just available for questions, Madam Chairman.
Okay.
And the one last thing I was just going to say is that if we're going to try and take advantage of what's going on with this shortage, the end of the match for the residency programs comes up in July. So if we're going to try and get those first graduates up here, the sooner we act, the better, obviously. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And you may feel free to come up here and sit if you like.
I appreciate it, but I've got Senate Finance going on.
All right. There's two components to that, and I want post-secondary of education to speak to this also. So if you want to come up. They talked about the price tag. They say that you are interested in having this, and we are for sure that we need to have such a program as this from an educational standpoint, social service standpoint. The money might be an issue. I would like for you to give your insights as to what you are supporting or not supporting this bill.
Senator Davis and the rest of the committee, for the record, I'm Pat Carr. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services. I've been asked to be available today to answer questions for you. I am also bringing the message today from the administration that the administration does not support this bill due to the price tag on the bill.
Does not?
Yes.
But you do have an understanding what the bill represents, and I would like to know if you are in agreement that this should be within the Department of Health and Social Service for this to be established by the commissioner?
Senator,
do they have any concerns with that on and not just the money?
Senator Davis, we within the department have been monitoring healthcare workforce for a number of years. It is within the purview of the responsibilities as part of the development of the healthcare work of the healthcare system and monitoring the availability of providers to serve our population and assuring access to care. The concerns about the price tag for the bill, as well as needing to add in additional staff to manage the program, are concerns of the administration.
Yeah. Excuse me. Just a minute. I do not have the fiscal note from the department. Are you in the process of drafting one?
The fiscal note prepared by the department has gone to the governor's office and should be available to you.
We don't have it at this time.
That was my question. I don't either.
No, we don't have it.
That's right.
And so, but they knew this bill was coming forth today, and yes. We assumed that we were going to get that. But at this point, we do not have it. So that's why the committee members don't have it, because my people did not receive it.
I see.
We would like to have that, and I know this bill is not going to go out today.
Yes.
But I also would like to know, did you share with Senator Olson already that the department did not support this bill?
That information should have reached Senator Olson yesterday.
All right, thank you. And I see Senator Dyson's hand.
My question. Well, we have a note here from that there's a zero impact on Department of Education.
Yeah, that's from education.
Yeah, but we don't have
not help.
Yeah, so I'm very interested in that as well.
Right.
And I will have questions for the sponsor when we have a chance.
Okay, well, we can have him come back up.
When it's convenient.
Did you want to say something about the bill, and then we'll call Senator Olson back?
Madam Chair, just the position or the role that ACPE, for the record, Diane Behrens, Executive Director of Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, The reason we were asked to participate in the discussion around this program was our familiarity with education loans, and we agreed that we could certainly play the part of a disbursing agent on the loan repayment piece if, in fact, such a program were put in place. So we're simply acting in a sort of a technical capacity.
And you have no problem with that because you just disperse the money. It's not your responsibility to come up with the money.
That's correct.
In your department. Okay. Thank you. Senator Olson?
Madam Chairman?
Yes. I think Senator Dyson has a question.
Yeah, I appreciate what I think you're trying to do here. I want to call your attention to the last page of the bill, page 6. The paragraph 7 there, I wasn't aware that we had a shortage of physical therapists in this state and that we needed to have loans to encourage them. Where did you guys get this list?
Through the chair.
I'll have Kendri Caesar answer that question since she's been working more intimately with the people that were actually crafting this bill. And we have Rod Beatty here who was also integral part of crafting the bill as well. Go ahead.
Okay.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, we included in the packet is the 2007 Alaska Health Workforce Vacancy Study, which gives further information on how these were prioritized.
Okay.
So physical therapist was included in that study, and also it was chosen in combination with consultation with the working group that helped to outline this bill or the proposed program.
All right, so I need to go look at that, and I'll find it here in my packet. I'm particularly concerned, and we've had a long-standing turf war in this state about the different master's levels counselors. We have master-level children's counselors, marriage and family counselors, and clinical counselors. I've forgotten the name, and indeed, they have the same training, and some would argue as good or better than social workers. And I see that the social workers are included here, and the other kind of counselors, and particularly the counselors that deal with sexually abused children and other kinds of abuse victims, and so on and so forth. They're not listed here, so I've got to look to see why they aren't and why the social workers are. The word on the street around here for the last 10 years has been the social workers have had the far best lobbyists and have done a good job of protecting their interests. I don't know if that's true. So I'll look at your, I got it here, workforce vacancy study. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Before we go any further, I want to also recognize Senator Ellis. He's been with us for some time, and he was not here when we gaveled in. Is there any other question coming from the members concerning the bill?
Not of the sponsor, but I would have.
I have some other people that you might want to. Suzanne Trick, are you on the phone?
Yes, this is Suzanne Trick, and I am on the phone if you would.
Are you willing to answer questions should they be questions
yes,
that need
course.
To be answered? Okay. We also have Mary Lowe. Lowe? L-O-E-B. Delissa Culpepper. Delissa Culpepper?
Yes.
Were you here to speak to the bill?
I'm here to speak to the bill, yes.
Was it just for questions or do you have a statement to make?
I have a statement to make.
Yes, you may do it now.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Delisa Carpenter. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And to the Senator and committee members, the trust has been working on health workforce issues for several years. We have a focus area on workforce development in partnership with the University of Alaska and the Department of Health and Social Services, and helped to fund the vacancy study to get statistics on where we are. All of our workforce areas that serve our beneficiaries, there are shortages across Alaska, both in rural and urban Alaska. So we have begun 3 years ago to put money into a larger workforce development issue, and loan repayment rose to the top as one area as a strategy that we could use. And so the last 2 years, we have crafted a small demonstration project around master's level or higher behavioral health positions across the state to help with loan repayment and recruiting. And therefore, we have been involved as part of the coalition that crafted the details of this bill, and believe that in order to compete with any of the other states, and we're really seeing that nationally, whether it's in our community health centers or the tribal health system or other public systems that serve Alaskans, we really are going to have to look to other incentives, and loan repayment and cash and housing stipends as incentives are going to become very important in the future. And so the trust would like to urge the committee members to consider funding and passing SB 139 to help us with the health workforce problems in Alaska.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? If there's no questions, we did receive the note from the department. It was just delivered to us. And this is the first hearing on this bill. We have a couple people that signed up to speak to the bill. And there's hearings going on up in finance. So Senator Ellis is going to have to go back up for the meeting, as well as Senator Olson. We were not planning on moving the bill today. We want to get the testimony and begin to look at the errors that need to be worked on. And we will bring this little bill back before us as previously heard. Other time.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Yeah, let me just for a moment continue the line of questioning I had here.
Sorry, go ahead, Senator.
That's right. I have in front of me the what I think you called the Health Workforce Vacancy Research Summary. On page 2 of it, you'll notice that in the table 1, it has a 17.7 vacancy rate of professions and therapists, and a 13.9 vacancy rate for behavioral health professionals. I think, and it looks to me like those are the two highest, or next to PAs, that was the highest rate of vacancy. And I think you guys have missed it when you didn't include those mental health professionals and therapists. And I think somebody bluffed you into putting the social workers in there instead of the mental health workers that table seems to show. Note in the paragraph immediately below it says, in the behavioral health occupational groups, the most acute shortages, high vacancy and high vacancy rates in the human services worker. In addition, overall behavioral health occupations were extremely numerous, 1,033, around 29%. And then over on page 3, the bottom, table 4, the bottom, it shows behavioral health clinicians. Those are the very ones I talked about, I think. It's the master's levels. And then the behavioral health ones in the table 3 is showing 11.6%. So I would commend those to your attention. Then table 5, it's 53%. Estimates.
All right, thank you for bringing that to the attention. And as I said, there's other work to be done on the bill. What we will do at this time, if there's no other questions from the committee, we'll call people up for public testimony at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Marie Darling.
My name is Marie Darlin, and I'm the on the Capital City Task Force for AARP, and you have our letter of support. And there's no sense in my going back through everything that the sponsors have already covered for you, other than to say that we do support this bill, and we do look upon it as something that's necessary if we're going to compete with all the other states that are already offering these kinds of recruitment and retention incentives. And just want to say that we also want to emphasize that sometimes the greatest cost to a state, which you're already involved in the discussion on the cost, but that there's a greater cost to the state too if there are no providers available to even take care of the people who have the needs. With that, we urge your support.
All right, thanks for your testimony. Any questions? Hear none? We'll go off site, and there's a Beth Solis.
Yes, this is Beth Searle from Anchorage.
Is that S-I-R-L-E-S?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
All right. You want to testify?
I do. Thank you very much for allowing me time. I am the director of the School of Social Work at the University of Alaska in Anchorage, and I am also the co-chair of the Mental Health Trust Authority's Workforce Development Focus Area Education and Training Committee. The Education and Training Committee, as Delisa Culpepper mentioned earlier, has been working for several years with providers to identify key workforce shortage areas in the state, and health workers are the primary shortage area identified. Our providers tell us regularly that their top priority is the recruitment and the retention of health care providers. We have looked at several workforce shortage studies. The vacancy study that you have before you today is one of several that we've reviewed. Others have looked at regional and statewide shortages. And there's no question that we have serious shortages of health providers, both tier one and tier two, identify the priority areas. And I'm here to speak in support of the bill, hoping that we will find a way of repaying loans for students who graduate with high debt and providing incentive programs to attract health providers to Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify to 139?
I would like to make a statement, please. My name is Tracy Curley. Can you hear me?
Yes, I do hear you.
Okay, I would just like to briefly state I am a full-time nurse practitioner student right now, and when I come out of school, I will have over $95,000 in student loans, and that makes it really hard to pay for a mortgage and pay back the student loans when you have no options. So that's all I have.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else?
Hello,
Madam Chair? Hello? Is there a Mary L-O-E-B there?
Hello?
Yes?
Can you hear me?
And who are you?
This is Mary Lowe.
Yes. Yes, we've called on you several times, so you want to testify?
Yes, I would.
Oh, you may do it at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a family physician at Sunshine Community Health Center in Talkeetna, Alaska, and have been here for the last 6 years and have been the medical director for Sunshine for the last 2 years. And I've had the experience firsthand of the enormous benefit this bill would have, particularly in meeting the unique healthcare needs of our rural communities in Alaska. I personally felt the distress of seeing, you know, the unmet medical and dental, as well as the counseling needs in my community personally. And just to give you an example of a real-life situation, a year and a half ago, our community was down from our regular 5 medical providers to just 2, and we did not have a mental health counselor at that time. And so that's 2 months, basically, medical providers, including myself, to staff 2 clinics. And during that time in the history of our clinic, know, I had the opportunity to interview lots of providers and administrators to rebuild our organization. And the issues that came up time and again in regards to, you know, meeting the needs of our community was, it was basically boiling down to them having to make some huge financial sacrifices to work for us. And you've already heard that, you know, the high cost of student loans that providers are coming out of school with, you know, I've seen estimates mostly around $100,000 of debt to pay back, including the cost of moving, the high cost of living in Alaska, and then sadly, the ever-rocketing cost of our health insurance. And I see this bill as basically one of the vital components of providing the much needed medical, dental, and counseling services to those who need it most in a very sustainable way that's cost effective, and simultaneously it's going to meet the needs of our community and will stimulate our rural economies. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Are there any questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify to 139? Would you come forward, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rod Beatty with the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this bill. First, we really appreciate Senator Olson putting this bill on the table, as well as Senators Bilikowski, Meyer, and Senator Davis for co-sponsoring it. This really addresses a critical hole we have in the healthcare workforce in the state of Alaska. We know we have a shortage because we have documents in front of us. One of them was referenced, the 2007 vacancy study. We also have the 2006 Physician Supply Task Force study, which just scratched the surface in terms of all the health occupations that we have issues about. But we also have real life stories from around the state, and I hear those on a regular basis. And I know the kinds of problems that our healthcare providers are having finding the right number and type of professionals to see Alaskans. And I hear from Alaskans who can't get in to see somebody for a medical problem that they have. So if we're going to be successful in addressing the gaps that Alaska has, and ours are quite serious when you compare them to other states, then we're going to have to come up with some solutions to do that. And those solutions generally take time to pay off. They're not things in this area anyway that we could set something in motion tomorrow and see any benefit from it in the near term. A good example, of course, is the investments you've made in the WAMI program to go from 10 to 20. And we saw that happen in the 2007 class at the University of Washington, but we won't see anybody coming out of that investment for 7 years. So what we have in the interim is a very, very serious gap that we need to try to find something to do that has a more immediate return. This bill would aim at that, and it would be, in my mind, the third leg of the stool. We have the WAMI school expansion, and then we also have the University of Alaska with very good expansions going on to grow our own healthcare professionals here. But we need something that's going to have some immediate impact on these 10 areas. So I see this as a rural area sponsored bill primarily because the shortages are there, but there are areas in some of our urban areas where the same kind of problems exist. And that if we don't go after these work-ready healthcare professionals more aggressively and more competitively with a limited number available, we're going to look worse rather than better 5 years from now. To do that, we have to have some funding. And this bill wasn't premised on the notion that there would be any diminishment of funding by those who are currently going after healthcare professionals. Our big hospitals, our big clinics will continue to do what they've been doing. I can report Fairbanks Memorial Hospital went after 25 physicians last year and was able to attract them all to Fairbanks. But they have the financial capacity to be able to do that for the community. If you look at our safety net providers, they don't have the discretionary income or the balance sheet that would pay for that. And this bill is aimed at recognizing that the state needs to make an investment to help those providers compete and also get professionals to their area. So while I'm here as one organizer of the broad-based group that came together to put this proposal in front of you, it's not aimed at hospitals, but rather primarily at community safety net providers who are willing to serve Medicare, Medicaid, and uninsured patients. Why are we so hospital so interested in the community workforce shortage? We conducted a statewide survey in late 2007. None of us would probably sit still for the entire survey, but it took 20 minutes. It was done by a national professional pollster who's done work in Alaska for 25 years and asked a series of 100 questions about healthcare attitudes, from which we've been able to garner some public opinion on where we should spend our time. But it was very clear from those responses that the public feels that hospitals are in a position to make the workforce needs known and to champion some solutions to address those needs, even if it isn't hospital-based where the needs are most pressing. So that has been selected by our board as one of the areas that we could give back to the community in terms of trying to help get that message out there and develop some strategies for putting those solutions together. And again, we've been working with a very broad-based group of people, and just a few, I don't have them all, besides ourselves, is Alaska Primary Care Association, Alaska Native Health Board, Alaska State Medical Association, the Alaska Dental Society, the Alaska Nurses Association, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, the Alaska Pharmacists Association, and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. While the Department of Health has provided excellent staff support, I understand as of today they can't support this because of funding and administrative burden on the department that would require some positions to manage. That's disappointing to me, I would think to others too, since we put so much time and effort in this. But nonetheless, I think we still want to put before you the idea that this is very much a solution that you should take a serious look at. I'd say the bill does not mandate a funding level each year. The fiscal note puts $7 million before you, and I think around a half a million to the department to run the program annually. But the idea is for $7 million, you could fund 90 healthcare professionals coming to the state based on characteristics that the department decides are the most pressing and locations where the department decides is most needy. And if $7 million isn't available and you can only put $3.5 million in, then you can fund half that many. But there could be years where you don't have any money to contribute whatsoever. But that doesn't make the program go away. It's still sitting there as a bank account that you can put funds in when you can afford to do that. And you know each year you put any money in that you're fully funding the full three-year commitment, because this is on an accrual basis, not a cash basis, that if you pick 90 people for $7 million, that commitment's good for 3 years. And you don't have to come back the next year and put anything more in. So to me, it's an excellent way to have something there that's ready to roll when you have the funding and you're clearly getting public comment that pressures are great in some areas of the state and you could do something to help relieve that. We don't pretend we have all the answers to how this program should be set up or run. We spent 10 months on it, but there's still things that questions that are asked that I don't have all the answers to either, and we've looked far and wide to see what's going on in other areas of the country and pulled the best that we can find into this. But we left a lot of discretion in this legislation for the department in terms of the operating entity and the advisory council and the criteria around what are hard to fill or very hard to fill areas and other decisions that would have to be made here. And we did that because we did not want to presuppose what the solution's final details should look like, but that we wanted to get something in place which the department could then refine with the help of that council. We did say in the bill, and I think it's a strong part of the bill, that the council, once the advisory committee, once they make a recommendation to the commissioner, needs to be honored. I've seen many advisory committees come together, having been a state official myself for 30 years, where ultimately in the end their input wasn't used. And this gives the commissioner the discretion to not use the advisory committee's recommendations, but has to put in writing the reasons for that. So it puts a little more burden there in terms of using the input that the commissioner is getting. So that said, we're very supportive of this legislation, and we think the time is now. We think that if we don't have something in place to help over the years ahead of us, that we have a very serious problem brewing in rural areas and in our underserved areas of the larger communities, and that if there's an expectation that that's going to be solved by these safety net providers with no resources to do it, that's probably not going to happen, and we would urge the committee to pass this out with a favorable recommendation and I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions of this? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thanks for helping, Rod. Senator Olson, that you had had made some assistance in preparing this thing. Did you have any input into the list of the different medical health professionals that would be included?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Dyson, we wrestled with that for several meetings. In fact, it came up almost at every meeting in terms of what are the ones that we should start with. And there were more than 10 on the table in the beginning. And to the physical therapy one, I hear regularly that that's one out there that people need, including physical therapy aids, assistance. And to the social worker one, the master's level clinical social worker was seen as a profession that could deal not just with behavioral health, but other kinds of issues, particularly in rural areas where you don't have the ability to have specialization as much in terms of the kind of problems that people have. And so that's why we put that one forward as a place to start and where to put our money. But we fully expected some dialogue on these 10, and that if we didn't pick the right 10, that would come up, and we could certainly talk through that and consider how we might make adjustments. But that was our best advice at this point to you in terms of where we should start with the 10 occupations that we need.
Yeah, but the supporting document doesn't talk about that, social workers, as a shortage we have, the workforce thing, and mentions very prominently the behavioral health and mental health workers. And so what were you guys thinking?
Again, through the chair, Senator Dyson, that was one of the input documents. But as we talked through it, the sense of the group and mental health was at the table, was that the social worker would be the stronger health profession to put in the package. And I guess I'd have to defer to them to talk about if we made a mistake and whether we should make an adjustment or not.
Thank you.
And also, the bill is here before us in the committee, and we can make the recommendations for change and do a new CS. That should not be a holding point because it's not listed the behavioral people that you wanted added to the bill. That could easily be taken care of. I thank you for your testimony and all the help that you've given for this. We know that this is an important piece of legislation, and we do need to do more things in our states to help bring these health professionals back to our state, and also help them with some of the debts that they have. And this will be a good source to do that. The bill can't be moved out of here today, but we're going to do some work on the bill. And I support this bill. I know it has some money out there that has to be put up front, but we'll do better by putting that money up front than not putting it there. We'll pay more on the back end for all these problems that we already know that we have, shortage of doctors, nurses, all kind of professionals that we can't keep here. And this is one way that we could entice our own young people to go away and come back here to school. We can bring other people in. This is not an unusual amount of money to put forward to do what this bill is trying to do. And if other states can afford to do it, I don't see why we can't. So we shouldn't say we don't support it simply because of the money, because things are better coming from the top down than they are working from the bottom up. But we will continue to work on this bill. Yes.
Madam Chair, if I discuss with Pat Carn, I guess, again, from the HHS.
Carney, yes.
If I could ask.
Would you come back up, please, Pat?
Yes, again, for the record, this is Pat Carr with the Department of Health and Social Services.
You may ask your question, Sister Pathfan.
You know, I understand right now that there's not support for the bill, and what I would like to hear later is in a couple of different areas. One, is there a recognition by the department of the need for attracting health care workers, or is the administration rejecting that recognition of the need? So if we start from that premises, I want to know whether there's a recognition for the need to attract healthcare workers. Then in the second, whether the position of the administration is because they want to reject certain fields as covered under the bill. In other words, is there recognition that some fields should be supported, or is there a rejection of some fields? And then, or is the position focused upon the number of positions, meaning 90, or is there some lesser number of positions at which the administration would say they support, or whether it's just in despite any recognition of the need that no money should be spent? Those are the issues that I would like to know.
Senator Paxton, through the chair to Senator Paxton. I think some of the questions that you have asked I may not be able to answer today. I may have to get further clarification from through our administration.
I would prefer that you take it back to your administration. He's letting it be known what his concerns are, and we don't expect for you to be the only one to have input into that.
And
so if you would take the questions to go back to the administration with them and have them give the answers later, that's fine. It doesn't have to be today.
Okay, Senator Davis, that would be most helpful to be able to get a more prepared response for you.
Right.
I will add that our staff and the department were staffed, and one of the largest studies that have been done related to healthcare workforce, and one of the most substantial ones, both to identify the need and in terms of the strategies, the Physician Supply Task Force was staffed by myself and my staff and was funded by the university. So we have been involved, as I mentioned in my earlier statements, we have been involved in looking at healthcare workforce. It is a responsibility of the department, and we do carry ongoing activities related to workforce. They're both funded, many of which are funded through federal grants and resources and through other special projects. On the other questions, and even related to this particular one, I can come back with you as the bill is moving through and provide a more, and also discuss with our administration and other ways to get responses back to your committee.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Davis.
There is one other person online. Shirley Hughes, are you there?
Hello. This is Shelley Hughes with the Alaska Primary Care Association. Thank you, Chair Davis and members of the committee. I worked with Rod on the crafting of this bill with a number of other folks around the table. We spent probably 50, 60 hours between August and December, and we started by looking at what other states were doing and what worked and what didn't work. And loan repayment and incentive programs were the most cost-effective and just effective overall. And so that's where we've put our focus. And I might mention that only 2% of American medical students are currently going into primary care. So there is a huge problem with having enough to go around. And Alaska is basically behind the eight ball right now and struggling. And what we hear from clinics, the 141 clinics that are across the state that are part of our association, is that they'll have a candidate lined up and things are looking pretty good, but then they'll get a call back often that they've been offered some sort of incentive in another state, and so they go elsewhere. We also hear that it can often be one of the initial questions that comes up, and if when they learn that Alaska does not have such a program, they move on elsewhere as well. So it is definitely a need, and we know that it would truly help. And I wanted to clarify, too, that the $7.5 million, the fiscal note, well, I guess we don't actually have one yet, but that amount is the encumbrance for a three-year award period for the 90 that would be in the first cohort. So it's not just a one-year. It would cover those 90 participants for a three-year award. So I just wanted to clarify that. Also, I wanted to mention that as we looked at the workforce vacancy study, Senator Chair, through to Senator Dyson's concern, is if you look at that data, it goes back. I don't have it in front of me. I'm actually in travel status, but it is we had people at the table who are working on recruitment for boards across the state for various organizations that were telling us what's been happening in the last couple of years. And that's how the physical therapist concern came up. They're having a very tough time. That was one of the hardest ones that the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium reported. They were having a very tough time recruiting in that particular category. And then as far as behavior health, you'll note that both psychologists
and licensed clinical social workers are included, and those are both behavior health in the behavior health category. And one of the elements we looked at is in order to keep a clinic's doors open, you have to have providers who can bill to Medicaid, and both psychologists and licensed clinical social workers are reimbursable through Medicaid. So that is an aspect, and I am not an expert on those other positions, but I believe that some of those are not billable. They are definitely necessary and important, but that did factor into the discussion. Not every single one on the list is billable, such as RNs, but physicians need the registered nurses in order to do their work. So there was, as Rod said, there was a lot of discussion as to who should be on that list, but you know, if there's new information and we find out that someone else should be on and someone should be pulled off, you know, that is what we came up with the information that we had at the time last fall.
Well, we thank
and
you.
And I think that's it.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Is there anyone else in the audience to testify? Is there anyone online? Hearing none, we're going to close the public testimony at this time. And the bill is back before us. We will close out on the bill because there's some work to be done and bring it back at a later time. Thanks for all the work that the various people have put into this bill. And I think we're off to a good start to come up with a real good piece of legislation. And we'll try to move on it just as fast as we can. At this time, we are going to adjourn that portion and move now to the nurse's bill is going to come up next. The overtime for nurses. Senate Bill 12. We've had it before. I don't know what needs to be done from the people that are interested in having this bill. We have a couple amendments that, just in case you decide that you might want those added to the bill. If not, and you want the bill to be moved out in its present form, that can be taken under consideration also. I have Mr. Obermeyer there, and the two people present, have you heard this bill before?
Yes, I was here when it was.
Yes, and Senator Dyson was here also. Are there any particular questions that you might have or concerns that you want to discuss on this bill?
Madam Chair, I'd enjoy having a chance to look at the two prospective amendments that you have.
Well, the reason that the amendments didn't come forward, I want the people that are wanting the bill to pass, a nurses association or somebody, to come forward and say if they are interested in having it in this bill. One had to do with a program that is used at one of the facilities in Anchorage. It's part of like the Baylor plan, but it's really not. They work on the weekends, 12 hours, 3 days or whatever, and then they have the rest of the time off. We had that in the last bill when it was here last year. It is not in the present bill. So we just brought back that same amendment just in case it came up. The other area where there might be some concern, who's going to speak to the nurse's bill? Would you come up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Mark Hickey, representing the Alaska Nurses Association. I don't have the, actually I do have from yesterday, this is the same language that you sent me. Madam Chair, Senator Dyson, the provision in front of you.
It's not in front of them.
The provision on the exemption that was added last year in the bill deals with, it's been referred to as a Baylor plan. It really isn't a Baylor plan, but it's a provision that allows on weekends, back-to-back eight-hour shifts with an eight-hour break and then an additional 16-hour shift at what we'd understood to be residential psychiatric treatment centers. I've been in discussions with their representative on this, and we're still talking about finding a solution. We don't support the language presently. We think there's plenty of time to come up with something that would work. The reason it was added last year is that the understanding was the nature of the care at this facility was different than an acute care 24-hour unit. It's does deal with youth, but the concern that we have about nurses being overly tired and in stressful situations and possibly making mistakes and putting patient safety at risk may not be as acute at these treatment centers. We're not entirely sure about that, and there is a hospital element to the one facility in Anchorage. So we're doing a little more research. There's a new facility in Fairbanks that's out there, and we have suggested to the bill sponsor to start out with this bill without this language in and let us work on it. It may be appropriate when we've done our research, but our concern is 16-hour straight shifts with an eight-hour break, another 16-hour straight shift. All the evidence shows that after a 12-hour shift, you're three times more likely to make a mistake. And the bill already has a provision that allows hospitals to get up to 14 hours consecutive work, which is a compromise we made last year with the bill, to try and give them adequate time to come up with staff and balance that with not having nurses work excessive amount of hours without adequate rest. So the short of it is the Nurse Association does not support this language today. We are working and we'll keep working with the folks from this facility and see if we can come up with something as the bill moves along.
So what you're saying, the bill in its present form is the way that you'd like for it to be moved from the committee?
That is correct.
All right. Are there any issues on this bill from the members that are present? Concerns? I think pretty much I've heard from most people and they said they had no problem with this bill. It was my desire to move this bill to the next committee or referral. It has to go to Labor and Commerce and then Finance, so it has a ways to go yet. Senator Dyson, will you have a problem with this bill being moved out of here today?
I would not.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Is there anybody here to testify on this bill?
Yes, there is. There's several of us, actually.
All right. I don't have anything in front of me yet. I guess I do now. We're going to go into public testimony at this time. Senate Bill 12. And I'll just go down the list. There's Ron Adler. In fact, there's a lot of them. You can talk it to death or you can let it be moved. Now, we have quite a few people. We got 30 minutes to get the testimony. Rod Adler. Debbie Thompson. Debbie Thompson?
Yes, I'm here.
You want to testify?
I don't need to testify. I was just on the line to answer questions, and Mark spoke very eloquently for us.
Okay, thank you. There's Ryan Smith. You wanted to testify, right?
Yes.
Ryan Smith?
Yes, Senator Davis, can you hear me?
Yes, we do.
My name is, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Ryan Smith. I'm the CEO at Central Peninsula Hospital and Heritage Place in Soldotna, Alaska. And I think a lot of these issues have been talked about in several previous testimonies. So I'll just focus my testimony to four issues and try to make it relatively brief. The first one is just to supplement the ASHNA data that I'm sure the committee has all seen in the past relative to our facility. We've provided some additional information, or we have some additional information showing that, you know, our nurses at the hospital and Heritage Place have worked approximately 14,000 shifts last year in 2008, and 44 of those 14,000 shifts were greater than 14 hours. 21 of those 44 were 14.25 hours. So really there were about 23 shifts out of 14,000 shifts worked at our hospital for nurses that were over 14 hours. The second issue really is related to the patient safety issues that have been raised, and I've heard some studies quoted, but again, I'm unaware of any Alaska study that mandatory overtime is used in Alaska or causing any patient safety problems. At our hospital, we do not use on-call or mandatory overtime to supplement a nursing shortage. In fact, I don't believe we have a nursing shortage on the peninsula. We make a significant contribution to the UAA Kenai Peninsula College Nursing Program to help subsidize an instructor position and have hired approximately 15 nurses from the prior two graduating classes at KPC to work at our hospital. The third point is that, again, you know, and you've heard this before, hospitals and nursing homes are highly regulated. This bill introduces another mandatory reporting requirement, increasing the cost for both us as healthcare employers and the state. As a participant of the Healthcare Commission, we've taken an interest in lowering the cost of healthcare. And finally, the last comment I have is relative to the collective bargaining comments that have been made. As you, we're currently in contract negotiations with our RNs at Central Peninsula Hospital and Heritage Place, and have always been willing to discuss the issue of limitations on mandatory overtime for RNs during these negotiations. In fact, I think that we've worked outside of the contract negotiation process in discussing with our operating and recovery room RNs a proposed plan to deal with this on-call provisions or issues in our OR. And again, just trying to solidify what is the definition of what you call mandatory or voluntary on-call. In our opinion, all on-call is could be viewed as being mandatory. So we try to work through those issues with our staff as part of that process. So I just wanted to raise those four issues again, and that's all I have for testimony. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Here no questions. We'll go to Tammy McCutcheon. Tammy McCutcheon?
Yes, this is Tammy McCutcheon.
Would you like to testify?
Yes, please. I'm the Human Resource Director at Alaska Regional Hospital. The way that this bill is currently written, we have what we refer to as the weekend flex program, where nurses in certain areas of the hospital are allowed to work two shifts a week and receive payment as well as benefits as a full-time employee. The language as it's currently written would limit those nurses' ability to be with their families during the week and not be able to participate in that program. Additionally, we have a lot of snowbirds that come up to the state and enjoy the fact that they're able to work and make a very good living during the summer months. So. Again, I just think that the way that the bill is currently written is going to limit opportunities for our nurses in Alaska and make it even harder for us to recruit and retain employees.
Any other? Yes, Senator Dyson has a question.
Yeah, I'm listening very carefully here and trying to figure out what you just said. So when those people come in and work the weekend and get credit for being a full-time employee, tell me how many hours they work on that weekend.
Two 12-hour shifts.
And with how much a break between them?
12 hours.
Okay. All right. And that qualifies them for your definition of a full-time worker?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Here none. Is there Brandy Proctor? Brandy Proctor?
I'm here. I'm a nurse over at North
Would Coast. You give your name and who you represent?
My name is Brandy Proctor, and I'm a nurse at North Star Behavioral Health. I would like to ask that amendment be made to continue the Baylor plan at our hospital throughout the state. The Baylor plan for us is two consecutive 16-hour shifts, Saturday and Sunday only. North Star does not have mandatory overtime, and it is not required of me to work the mandatory overtime. I voluntarily work the 16-hour shift. If I were to feel impaired by for any reason, I would be released from working, And it's also consistent for the milieu over at the facility. There's some things that it benefits for me and my family is that it allows me to be off during the week and be at home with my younger children, and therefore it decreases my child care costs and increases my time spent at home with my family by being allowed to work these 16-hour shifts only on the weekends.
Thank you for your testimony, and here are no questions at this time. Tracy Curley.
Hi, my name is Tracy Curley. I also work the what's known as a modified Baylor plan at North Star Hospital, which, as Brandy stated, was a 16-hour shift on Saturday and then with an 8-hour break in between another 16-hour shift on Sunday. As I stated earlier, I'm currently a full-time nurse practitioner student, and without this job opportunity, I would have no way of, you know, completing my schooling in the nature that I do. My other concern is for our patients. We have a very unstable and oftentimes very acute population at North Star, and during the week, they have school and other activities that bring them off the unit, and unfortunately, on the weekends, their most of their time is spent on the unit. It really benefits our population to have one registered nurse available during their waking hours. It provides a consistent milieu for our kids there, which is first and foremost most important to their safety. That's my concern. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? We have Deidre Joseph.
Hi, my name is Deidre Joseph. I'm also here in support of North Star Hospital. I do work the 16-hour Baylor plan as well. Mine crosses over from Friday to Saturday. I was a nursing student during the time that actually this plan was offered to me as a technician, and it allowed me to attend UAA and graduate from UAA with a bachelor's degree in nursing. As I got my bachelor's degree, I turned over to this position as an RN, and it's benefited me and my family in certain ways because we fell in a bind after Hurricane Katrina. I had to move my family up so forth and so on, so the debt was increased. So at this current time, working on the weekend and getting the full-time benefits, so forth and so on, and also picking up some additional hours with another clinic provides me with a way of getting out of debt and getting some things that have fell through back together and some pieces that I would not have the opportunity to do so. It also increases my time with my family as we go through a death with my father and some other things. It provides opportunities and options for nurses. It's not so much, you know, a concern so forth as the patients being at risk. I think our hospital does very well with keeping down significant errors and things of that sort. We always get feedback on how we're doing, what we need to increase or decrease, and to do better for our patients. And the Baylor plan has never come up in that hospital as being a localized point where those errors are maintained just a part of the Baylor plan, or those nurses that's involved in the Baylor. So I feel like the best way that I know how to continue to put my best foot forward and in times of struggle to get myself back on track, as well as look at other people who are trying to get their lives back together by going to school or increasing their abilities to be better as nurses, so forth and so on. That's my my opinion on that.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? There's a Levi Washington, also from North Star.
Yes, it is, Madam Chairman. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'm an RN manager on the Baylor plan at North Star as well. And I echo everything that my co-workers have said. And additionally, I also have the opportunity to track patient safety. And we have very, very low, we hadn't incurred any issues on nurses working the Baylor plan. In fact, the attendance of Baylor employees have been 100%. I can attest that my attendance has been 100% on that, which enhances their continuity of care. It also provides a certain security to the kids to look at me through one shift, and I put them to bed. And they say, don't worry about it, I'll be there tonight. If you have any issues, just call for me, I'll come down and see you. And that gives them, they've been abused and been a lot of distrust, and they get to count on you being there. and it really helps. We're always tracking patient safety. We embrace JCO. That's what we are always pushing for. That's our part. And patient safety is one of the things we want. It also allows me to be the best dad in the world with my own daughter. And I look at the sleep thing, and I want to realize that I've studied a little bit of sleep, and there's a huge genetic variation that needs to be considered. There's some people that need a little more, need a little less, and I don't think it's correct to penalize people who need a little less recover than ones that don't. We've had nurses that worked the Baylor plan who tried it, and they said, you know what, this doesn't work for me. They didn't get penalized. No, sir, so that's fine. They went right back to the schedule that they felt comfortable. That's why nurses get the opportunity to work a day shift, some work night shift. You find what works for you so you can recover. Also, what are we? The way this language is written, it doesn't address it. Nurses having multiple jobs. Do it? Well, do you work one job, 12 hours at this facility? Does it prevent you from working somewhere else? It does not. And most nurses, typically, I don't have it in front of me, but they typically have a little pool, what we call pool or intermittent job, just to help with the economy. So I don't see how the way the language is working, it's really there to benefit patient safety or looking out for nurses. So we need to go back to it and look at it. And the Nurse Association said, well, let's don't put the language in. Let's do some research. I say leave the language in. Do the research. Don't undo something that hasn't proven to be broken, and then decide, well, you know, we'll put it back. Let's put the amendment that was in there last year back in, please, and then we'll do more research and see if, where we're at, and then we'll make the adjustment. But at this juncture, I don't see how I don't understand the benefit. What is the mark you're doing? Is it patient safety? There's not proving that it's unsafe on our facility. There's not as much direct acute care in our facility. There's a lot of, movie time with kids. There's a lot of outings. We take our kids out to ski. We take them to YMCA. There's not that kind of, and I also had the opportunity to work. I do intermittent on the 12 hours as native, and it's much, much challenging, to make that interchange. So we definitely support the Baylor plan that was in the language that was left out this year, and we would like to continue that. And there again, I want to really thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Well, thank you, Mr. Washington, and we appreciate your testimony. We've heard you, all of you, and that will be taken under consideration as we further explore this bill. Is there anyone else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 12?
Yes, this is Robin Richardson from Alaska Regional Hospital, if I may take a moment.
Yes, you may. I don't have your name. Yes.
It's Robin.
Yes.
Okay. I'm the director of the critical care services at Alaska Regional, and a couple of points. We don't have mandatory overtime for our nursing staff, NICU or the ER department. We do have the Baylor program, we call it the Weekend Flex Program, in the ICU, which, as previously mentioned, for Alaska Regional is two 12-hour shifts, Friday night, Saturday night, or Saturday, Sunday. We probably at least 50% of my staff full-time in the ICU, whether it's Baylor or not, also work at another facility. So I don't think that nurses are going to be any more tired because they work the Baylor versus working six or even seven 12-hour shifts between two or even three facilities. I don't think that really has a bearing on anything. I don't believe that having a certain program, such as the Baylor, increases the risk for more patient error by increasing patient safety issues. I have not, as a director, had any increase. We've had the Baylor for over a year. I have not had any increase in incident reports, errors based on the Baylor program or hours worked. In addition, it has been a huge nurse satisfier. It has been in that reflects in many ways. A happy nurse makes happy patient care. Happy patient care makes happy patients, which makes happy doctors, and so on and so on. It's also been a huge retention of getting nurses from the lower 48 up here to Alaska. It's a huge benefit for them, as others have mentioned, to go to school, to be with their family, to enjoy Alaska while still maintaining a full-time job and full-time benefit. So we all benefit by this program. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions?
Yes.
I would like to, at this time, recognize that we have with us Senator Thomas. He's joined us. He's here from finance, so he's been here quite a while. I just had not recognized him.
And I had a question.
You have a question?
I do.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a couple of questions. I'm not sure who cares to answer it, but the 16-hour shifts that are worked on the weekend, what does that typically mean for a 7-day work week then? If somebody works Friday, Saturday, Sunday, how does that offset hours work during the week, or is it just in addition to? And the other question, I guess, would be what is the average hourly wage straight time of a nurse, average thereabouts?
I can speak to the Baylor plan at North Star on the weekends.
Would you state your name before you answer the question, please?
I apologize. Tracy Curley?
Yes.
We do not work during the week. So the 16 hours on Saturday and the 16 hours on Sunday is our work week. And then we are off Monday through Friday.
So it's a 2-day work week.
32 hours.
And we are paid 40 hours. With full benefits.
Okay. This is Robin Richardson at Alaska Regional. The nurses work 212 and get paid for 36 with full benefits. The average wage, our wage is based on their years of experience. In the ICU, I can only speak for offhand at the ICU at the moment. The average, their base rate does not change because they're on Baylor. They're still paid the same rate. They're just paid an additional 12 hours of their base pay without their certification or shift differential. The average wage is no different than what their wage would be if they worked Monday through Friday.
And what is that average wage? I realize it varies, but just a ballpark, even a range, if you had a range of what do you pay?
It's Robin Richardson again. We require that you have a minimum of 2 years experience to even get in the ICU. So I figure we have nurses that are 2 or 3 years out of school, all the way to 30 years out of school. So on average, I would say we're probably around the $28 an hour range if you figure nurses take the middle road and say 10 to 12 years of experience.
Thank you.
Any other question? Is there anyone else signed up to testify? Hearing none, we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 12. Is there any closing remarks that need to be made by the Nurses Association or their representatives? Hearing none, what's the pleasure of the committee for this bill?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Having heard the last of testimony, it would be my preference that we put in the amendment that you had in last year. But if you guys don't choose to do that, we'll honor my commitment earlier to pass the bill out.
Yeah, the commitment that I make, I did not plan to put it in this particular bill in this committee. And the sponsors, the people that are asking for this bill to be introduced by me said that they would work on it at the next committee level. So we do have the amendment, but I didn't want to put them in there today.
I understand.
All right, thank you.
Well, given that, I'll make the motion that we pass Senate Bill 12 from Health and Social Services to the next committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection to that? Hearing no objection, then we'll move it to the next committee referral along with the fiscal notes that's attached. and we don't have time to take up a full bill. I have one more bill on the schedule, and we will roll it over as a to the next committee.
Madam Chair, meeting. I would suggest if there's anybody that wanted to testify on that and can't come back, you might give them an opportunity.
Oh, you mean the bill that haven't been heard?
Yeah, the one that was number
I didn't think about that.
101.
Yes. Is there anybody in the audience on, to testify on 101 or online?
Yes, this is Joan Diamond. I wanted to testify on Senate Bill 101.
Okay, we do have time that we could take the public testimony on that. And just before you do that, I want Mr. Obermeyer to come up and just give a brief overview of the bill so the public will know what we're talking about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The bill that's before you is the bill relating to questionnaires and surveys administered in public schools. And the primary reason for this bill was to allow the youth or risk behavior survey to be administered in the schools without parental consent and what they call passive consent, where if parents who are given adequate notice and an opportunity to review the survey don't want their children to take it, they can, in writing, notify the school they don't want their children to participate. In addition, we wrote in an exception where if a child sitting at the survey does not want to answer any particular questions, they may do so and or not take the survey at all. And that's the main reason for this particular survey, which is so important to all of the school districts and to the Centers for Disease Control to try to find out what are the activities that most affect the health and welfare of the children in the public school system.
Thank you. Also, because the districts and nonprofit organization have been having problem getting enough people to take the survey, that is why the change is being made. This bill have been heard in education. This is the second committee of referral. There are some people to testify on it, and we'll go into the testimony at this time. Jennifer Smith? Smith? Jennifer? Jennifer Smith, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer Schmidt, 1093 Steel Creek Road in Fairbanks. And I am speaking in favor of the passive consent for the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. I'm speaking today as a private citizen, but one who has been a nurse in Alaska since 1972. And I've also served 12 years as a school board member up until this November when I didn't run again for election. And I'm also a parent. I'm supportive of this change because the Youth Risk Behavior Survey is a standardized tool. It's validated, it's anonymous, and there are guidelines that protect students and families that are from small communities. You know, the smaller community data would be aggregated so that no one would be able to figure out who in what little town has what kinds of problems. And there's also nothing in the YRBS that students haven't heard of through either songs or the media. I think it's important to realize that the YRBS does not only address sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and I say that in quotes. It also addresses things like seatbelt use, you know, diet and activity. And as we're looking at obesity and lack of fitness in young people, we need to know what the trends are there. In my tenure as a school board member, I served on the curriculum committee, the wellness committee. We dealt with lots of discipline issues, as you know, and principals, health teachers, PTAs, and school board members, in order to make good decisions about programs and curriculum, whether our curriculum is adequately addressing the issues that students are dealing with, really need to have good data. One year, I know our program planning and evaluation department put in tremendous effort, up to 3 phone calls to families to get enough students to participate. And one year there wasn't enough state data. So even though we had local data, we couldn't compare it to the state. We could only compared to national. Other providers and agencies that I work with in the community to address adolescent health issues, such as the Safe Kids Coalition, the Mental Health Center, Public Health, Boys and Girls Club, and pediatricians need to know what's going on, what trends are affecting our kids, what's going up, what's coming down. For instance, tobacco use has really decreased. Seatbelt use has increased, but some other indicators aren't very good. And as a parent, I think it's really important to know what's going on. I've done classes for parents of teenagers or soon-to-be teenagers so that they would be aware of what issues are important to discuss with their kids. And when they look at the youth risk behavior data, you know, it's a little eye-opener. They can actually, if the information shared with parents, they can say, gee, do you really think this is going on in our community? And you can be sure that a lot of kids, even if they aren't involved in some of the alcohol and drug behavior and other things, they might say, oh, yeah, or no, I haven't run into that. And it's a good discussion starter. I believe that the public expects school districts to be efficient and data-driven. And I think that by supporting this change that would allow for passive parental consent, it will help school districts be more efficient and data-driven and will help both the community and school districts better address the needs of teens. And thank you very much. I'll be gone for a couple weeks. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
And we thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Here none is Joanne Diamond.
Yes, this is Joan Diamond, and I am representing Alaska Public Health Association in regards to supporting changing the requirement for participation in the youth risk behavior survey from the active parental consent to the passive parental consent. So again, it is not an issue about parental consent. It's just giving parents the opportunity to opt out of the survey for their child if they so want to. The other issue, too, and I do agree with what the past person was describing. In addition, a couple of points. One, the state does spend a lot of money, up to $75,000, in trying to, through any number of different incentives, trying to get these consent forms back. It's incredibly labor-intensive in order to get enough permissions back in order to get enough people to participate so that it is valid kind of data that's being collected. In addition, I am also a 28-year public health nurse and planner with the Department of Health, and go all the way back to 1995 when the survey first began, and worked very hard in getting it implemented in the Anchorage schools. It was always an issue, and even as a parent who's both my kids who are now in college or out of college, both went through this survey. And it was always an issue about, as a parent, wanting time for academics. There was always an issue of, is this going to take away from classroom time that we want our kids so badly to have? And it turned out that it was not an interference. I think it was, and still continues to be, important data. And it goes even beyond the nonprofits that we were talking about. I think that it still has a lot of use, even with teachers, to understand just exactly what kind of data has been collected. A lot of the learning is a lot more relevant in the classrooms when they understand what the kids are thinking. The other piece that goes hand in hand is there's a lot that can be done with the churches and the youth leaders who have this data. Sometimes I think that we have a lot more that we can do with it outside the school that can bring a lot of value to the community. I think that's probably the best I can say. I know that we're only one of three states left that still has active consent. So most people are understand the value and have gone to a passive consent. Thank you.
We thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions?
Sure.
Yes, Senator
Thomas. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I take it that you believe that this is a step in the direction of being proactive rather than reactive to the things that that are so difficult in many cases for hardworking people to understand what their kids are actually doing in school. or out of school, I guess, we see in their lives, I guess. Is that correct to assume that?
This is a proactive approach to preparing students for learning? I'm not sure.
Not preparing students for learning, but preparing students as well as educators and everybody that they're going to come in contact with for what's going on in their lives and how we may intervene if necessary, or at least help them learn better or be more successful if we have a better idea of what kind of things they are participating in, particularly in the negative areas.
I think it's proactive. I want to clarify, though, about being proactive. A lot of times, with this kind of data, we can provide an environment where our kids can succeed. I think we're trying not to be reactive. Knowing a lot of this data helps us design an environment for students to succeed. You have to set up a winning situation for kids to succeed instead of reacting when they do something wrong. And I think that this data is being used in trying to create the kind of environment we want our students to have.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have one other person, Paula Easley. Are you there, Paula?
Yes, Madam Chairman.
Would you like to testify?
Easley, I'm a trustee for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and I'm chair of the Trust Planning Committee, and I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 101. The language authorizing passive consent for students to participate in this biennial survey will significantly increase each school's level of participation. Since the language change in 1999, the survey results have been very discouraging. The new language enables Alaska schools to meet the 60% response requirement at much less cost. And it also provides, as other people have stated, adequate procedures for parents and students to opt out if they choose. The trustees, last November, reluctantly authorized spending $50,000 for incentives to urge greater participation in this year's survey. However, we agreed to strongly support legislation that would improve the response rates of future surveys and, of course, to save money. It will also reduce the administrative burden for participating schools substantially. I'd like to stress that information gleaned from this survey is critical to the Trust's extensive planning activities. The survey provides reliable data for identifying and following trends for high school students engaging in risky behaviors, and it is also used for comparing data with other states and national statistics. I know you are aware of the attempted suicide rate in Alaska that it's, I believe, close to 11%, which is about 4% higher than the national rate. That's the kind of information that we need. The trust, the state agencies, the schools, and our partner boards all need this data to help identify where efforts and dollars are best directed and which programs are having the most impact. Thank you for allowing me to testify on Senate Bill 101.
And we thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Hearing no questions, is there anyone else signed up to testify? Off-net? Anyone in the building here, in the room? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony at this time. And we're not planning to move this out of the committee. We'll bring it back on the previous bill heard the next meeting.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah.
Senator Dyson?
I have an excused absence starting at noon on Friday. If you intend to hear it and act on this bill on Friday, I'll try to change my travel plans.
I plan to bring it back Friday, but is that going to be a problem? You're leaving in the midday flight, right?
Yeah. So I don't want you to act on it when I'm not here. So if you're going
to. Oh, you don't? Well, you can. We can send it out of the committee now, and you can act on it. Because otherwise, I plan to bring it back Friday. You won't be here.
All right. You want to do it right now?
Yes, why not?
All right. I'd like your permission to speak against the bill.
You want to speak against the bill? So we're not going to do anything then, because if you're going to not vote for it, I still will be bringing it back.
All right. So
so it won't matter.
Yep.
But you may speak to it, because you might not get to do that on Friday.
Yep. So
I'll let you speak to it.
And if I am able to change my plans and get back on Friday, then I'll ask for the privilege of reiterating some of my remarks.
Okay. All you right. know, we are just past our time, so if you want to make a statement in case you're not here.
I was the author of the original legislation that made this active permission required from parents to allow their children in. And our state is one of the few in the nation that has privacy in the state constitution, for which I'm grateful. And it is my view that government does not have the right to know these personal information about children and families. And what we have here is a bunch of nice people who are wanting to get more surveys so they can get more money to do good things for kids. And I appreciate that. But indeed, every one of those school districts is always able to get active permission for the kids to get vaccinations or go on field trips and stuff. There's quite a few school districts in this state, except ours, who are able to get active permission from the parents to do what I consider to be an invasion of family and child privacy. And school districts wanting to be that invasive without active permission from the parents, I consider to be an affront to parental rights. And and the questions are quite invasive and violate, I think, the innocence of some children's minds. And there are questions there that, and there have been, that I think that several of us would say are sure interesting and none of government's business. And yes, the more information you have, the better decisions you can make, but we have the job here of balancing those interests of family privacy, parental rights, and so on. You have refused to hear the bill on parental rights on notification or permission on abortion, and here we have one that existing law that protects parents' rights to what government asks of their children, and I think that's an important right. I'll tell you that when it passed the House, it was 33-1. In the Senate, when it passed 99, it was 17-1.
I know that's the truth, and it's been on the book, and it's been causing problems ever since that time. We don't get enough students to participate in it. There is an opt-out. If parents do not want to have their children take it, they sign the slip and they don't take it. There's also a provision in there that the child will not have to answer the questions if they don't want to answer. So it's nothing that's invasive that's trying to be taking that away from the parents.
Yeah,
and parents are fully involved. Over the United States, they are going back to change that because they are not getting the number of students that they need
to do
the survey.
And that's the classic argument of pragmatism. I'm talking about fundamental rights of privacy that you do not think is as important as I do.
Do you not think if it was that much concern about it that people would not voice their opinion and say, oh, no. They'd be all over the place saying, we're not going to go for that. We don't care if 49 states have it.
Well,
we're not going to have it.
They have certainly the right to make whatever decision they want, but the people in this state, acting through their elected representatives here, voted overwhelmingly to protect parental rights.
They did years ago, yes.
And privacy.
And that was the trend at that time, so I know that.
Yeah, and I think there's a trend to protect human rights and privacy I hope never perishes in this state.
I appreciate your concern about that, Senator Dyson. Don't want to debate you on it. We don't have the time. If we had the time, I would. Because you know I have done that now. I stayed up with you one night all night debating an issue because it was important enough to both of us. But we will adjourn at this point.
All right.
And bring you this back on Friday.